Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the February 20th, 2012 Heretics Hour. I am live on Voice of Reason Network, and I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm happy to be with you tonight. I'll take your calls in the second hour. The number to call then is 1-855-4776-2283. Well, today is President's Day in the United States, so just a few words about that. You know, President's Day was previously Washington's birthday, and the first attempt to create a President's Day occurred in 1951 when the President's Day National Committee was formed by Harold Stonebridge Fisher of Compton, California. Now, this man had not a very good idea, but he was really focused on it. And he became the national executive director of this President's Day National Committee for the next two decades, trying to get this passed in Congress. The purpose was that we would not honor any particular president, but we would honor the office of the presidency. Now, if that isn't a slippery thing to do, in my opinion, to honor an office, therefore anyone who holds that office is honored because of it. Do you see what's wrong with that? This is something you might do for those who sit on a throne, a king or queen or some royalty, but not for those who are elected to carry out an executive office. It should always be the merit of the man or woman that deserves honor or not. It's not automatic. And that's how all these traitors hide and have been hiding and are hiding. Now, more about this President's Day. We were supposed to observe something, learn more about our presidents or whatever. But what it has become is a day in which many stores, department stores especially, and especially car dealers, wholesales. And so this is what happens to these holidays. Until the late 1980s, corporate businesses generally closed on this day. But now they don't, and in fact not only businesses are open, but schools are now, a lot of schools or colleges and universities are open, and delivery services and public transit and so on. So it's pretty much just a regular day, but it's marked on the calendar, and public school children and all federal employees and so on get a day off. Now, get this, though. The idea is that President's Day has lost some of its meaning and some of its importance because of the observance of the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., which is not too much ahead of it in January. So, well, since the corporations lose money because they close for the observance of Martin Luther King Jr., they don't want to close for President's Day. And then sometimes they link these together for a midwinter recess and so on. So here you have Martin Luther King Jr. Day outstripping or out in importance, and it is. Gets much more attention than our President's Day. Now, not that I like President's Day. I would prefer to have Washington's birthday. I think that would be the best thing. But this is how times change. Okay, and that's all the time that I have to spend on President's Day. But I thought it was kind of interesting. Now, I'm going to read from the fire, as I have been doing, and the bombing of Germany, 1940-1945. Last week I talked about Dresden, and I'm going to have a few more things, a couple things to say about Dresden in the second half hour. But the reading tonight is going to be on the city of Forzheim. And I want to tell you before I start, it will be mentioned in the reading, but that Forzheim was in the Baden-Württemberg area down in the south. It's considered like the entrance, one of the entrances to the Black Forest. And it was a non-industrial city. It was a jewelry and watchmaking center. And so British propaganda put out that Forzheim, after they, bombed it, or maybe when they decided they wanted to bomb it, that Forzheim was one of the centers of the German jewelry and watchmaking trade and is therefore likely to have become of considerable importance to the production of precision instruments that would somehow be helpful to the war effort for the Germans. So this was their justification for what they did, for which they had no real evidence or facts whatsoever. But I do want to say that this someone named Detlef Siebert, who's fairly well known, wrote for the BBC History website that, quote, cities like Würzburg and Forzheim were selected primarily because they were easy for the bombers to find and destroy, because they had a medieval center, that is to say a very historic and irreplaceable old center. They were expected to be particularly vulnerable to fire attack. Well, you'll find that these are the same things that that Friedrich, Jörg Friedrich, says in his book here that I'm going to be reading. So I will start right now. It's already 8:10. The U.S. 8th Air Force preferred to shut down the system with precision strikes on key locations, on a key location. As of mid-1943, the German sky had been divided up between the British and the Americans. The British flew the night raids and the Americans flew the day. I'm going to skip a few sentences along here and say, in their search for the key ingredient in the manufacture of armaments, the linchpin whose destruction, in their search for the key ingredients in the manufacture of armaments, the economists decided upon the ball bearing. Because the Germans produced them mostly in Schweinfurt and Regensburg, these cities needed to be targeted in an intelligent way. They say the locations were well defended in these places where they were producing ball bearings, and there were 16% losses for the bombers. The 1st and 4th bombardment wings turned out to be far more sensitive than the ball bearing industry. During their bloody summer, that's what the United States called their first summer of heavy bombing, the U.S. 8th Air Force learned the bloody lesson that of all unstable systems, a bomber fleet in the sky is one of the most unstable. This led the Americans to decide that instead of seeking the enemy's most vulnerable point, they would make themselves invulnerable. For the most part, the bomber was wounded by the fighter. To fight the fighter, the bomber had to hunt it, its airfields and hangars. Its production and the production of its fuel had to be eliminated. We're talking about the fighter, of course, the enemy fighter aircraft. If one's own aircraft controlled the air unchallenged, then there was no need to search for key sites on the ground. You could simply bomb everything until the stones started to melt. The enemy whose defenses failed ceased to be an adversary and became instead an object of punishment. From the beginning of the Battle of the Ruhr until the end of 1943, the weapon killed an average of 8,100 civilians each month. That is the bomber. 13,500 starting from July 1944. So it increased quite a bit after that. In between, the U.S. Air Force shut down the German aircraft industry during that time, between the end of 43 and the summer of 44. The ratio, when the aircraft industry, a strictly military target, lay in ruins, Germany on the ground was helpless in the face of the force in the sky. Taking advantage of the situation, the British-American fleet dropped 370,000 tons of bombs between January and April 1945, far more than one-fourth of the total amount of bombs dropped. During that time, the British and Americans bombed full-time, suffering virtually no losses. I see this. I have a little word here, cowardly, I say. The convergence of the British and the American weapons had already taken place in the first half of 1944, when the British continued to burn down cities while the U.S. forces set their sights on what obstructed them the most, the German fighter fleet. Shutting down the fighter weapon as regards production, airfields, and aircraft was to the bombing war what breaching the Mooney Dam was to the Ruhr Valley. Much like the bottled-up destructive force unleashed in the flooding of the valley, the flood of bombers would be unstoppable in the absence of enemy fighter squadrons. All that still slowed down the Battle of the Ruhr was the destructibility of the destroyers. The wave that buried everything beneath it did not come from Mooney Lake. That kind of secret weapon was an illusion of the professors in the service of the air war. Harris, we're back to Bomber Harris again, considered such things nonsense, panacea targets, miracle drugs, cure-alls. No, it was the offensive waves of Lancasters and Boeing 17s, unaccountable and unhindered, that would continue to raise cities to the ground until none remained. That is why, in the final stretch before the capitulation, the cities of Freiburg, Heilbronn, Nuremberg, Halberstadt, Worms, Forsheim, Trier, Chemnitz, Potsdam, Dresden, Danzig, and others had to go. A steamroller worked its way through Germany one last time from January to May 1945. It was almost totally devoid of military purpose and was free of all tactical risk. Now, this is a quote from Harris. He said, "We had to attack the already devastated cities of the Ruhr in order to finish off such industries as had begun to produce again during the long respite from bombing. In Essen and many other towns, almost everything that could be burnt was already reduced to ashes, and we could therefore only attack with high-explosive bombs, which in proportion to their bulk weigh far more than incendiaries. I had some time ago foreseen that the time might come when we should need an enormously larger supply of heavy-case high-explosive bombs than before, when our main weapons had been the 4-pound incendiary and the 4,000-pound blast bomb. This latter was, of course, essentially a weapon for use against intact buildings and was no great use against already ruined cities in which life was mostly going on in cellars." That was Bomber Harris explaining his strategy. To continue, I will come down a few more sentences. This raising of towns along the battle line, while related to the war, was not always vital to the war effort, which is what I said about those two cities in the beginning. While it might look the same as Harris's devastation of ruins, it differed as regards intention. Harris's aims joined forces with the final military offensives without actually being part of them, because Harris's aims served no purpose. Why was Forsheim reduced to ashes on the night of February 23, 1945, with a fire zone of 1.7 square miles and 20,000 casualties? Master bomber Edwin Swales was posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross for that mission. In addition to Hamburg, Kassel, and Dresden, Forsheim is one of the dozen or so cities in which a firestorm developed. The firestorm is the apotheosis of fire raising. Until September 1944, it could not be deliberately produced. It could only be triggered when human destructive rage coupled perfectly with natural phenomena. Atmospheric reactions could pass an unforeseen, rampant, and aggressive rage onto the incendiary device. The British welcomed this divine boon and immediately tried to determine a mathematical formula for producing it. That seemed an impossible task, since it involved too many variables and unknowns. The general phenomenon had already been described in 1927 by Lieutenant Colonel Wilhelm Siegert. inspector of the flying troops in Imperial Germany during World War I. The weekly magazine Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung reported, now this, get this, this is a German writing this, a German after, right after World War I. It is possible to start numerous sources of fire in a city, such as the existing fire departments cannot extinguish all of them at once. The seeds of catastrophes are thus sown. The individual fires merge into a major blaze. The superheated air shoots upward like a giant chimney. The air that rushes in along the ground creates the firestorm, which in turn causes the smaller fires to unfurl completely. So this says to me that Germans knew how to do this too. They understood firestorms, but they weren't trying to create firestorms in British cities, were they? The physics of this cycle, the wide area conflagrations, the vertically flaring hot air, the storm that was sucked in horizontally to fill the vacuum that in turn fanned the area blaze, all this was more powerful than any and all munitions. The casualty figures jumped to five digits, a magnitude that for a single bomb drop seemed exclusive to the atomic bomb. Forsheim proved that was not the case. In February 1945, there were 65,000 people in Forsheim. In August 1945, in Nagasaki, there were more than 300,000, where the attack killed 39,000 people, about one in seven. In Forsheim, there were 20,277 deaths, almost one in three. So more people died in Forsheim compared as to the population than did in Nagasaki. Siegert's theory was experienced in practice by the Forsheimers. Soldier Wilhelm Recker was among those who fled the deceiving security of the cellars beneath the burning apartment buildings. And this is his testimony. They dunked blankets and towels in the bucket, wrapped them around themselves, and ran through the flames to the Enns River, where they doused themselves again with water, since the heat and flying sparks were incredible. Sedan Square converged the flames from all the streets leading into it and then let the scorching force escape toward the bridge. The flames shot over it into the city center, and there the mushroom rose up steeply, drawing all the fire into its shaft. During this hour, the radiant heat was so intense that people were jumping into the wintry cold river. That was the end of that. The author continues, the city built at the confluence of the Enns and the Nagold was rich with water. That was why many drowned in the firestorm. Those who entrusted themselves to the cellar did not know its treachery. Theologian Otto Recker wrote, this may be related to the relative of the Wilhelm Recker, my brother-in-law leaped down and lit up the room with matches. A relative was leaning against a wall with both hands pressed against the stone. She was facing the escape shaft as if she were alive. Opposite her was a man with his back against the wall and his arms outstretched. There were four women on a bench. They were leaning forward slightly with their arms folded as if sleeping peacefully. All of them had died within a single moment. The blast killed them. Back to the author. It was the work of the 330 500-pound aerial mines. In the morning rain, Professor Fritz Loeffler looked for the veins of a town, its streets. Where were there still any streets? You had to climb over rocks, he said, and timbers, and then you'd suddenly see, in an open space or in the windowless storefront of the Palace Cafe, the bloated, unclothed, skeletal remains of the working maidens, charred by the dozens. Cellars worked like crematoria. The vaulted cellar was still in good condition, wrote Hermine Lautenschlager, and this is what she wrote. There were no doors anywhere, no cabinets or boxes remained, which my sister had used to store her best things. On the floor, and especially along the wall, there were piles of ashes here and there. Part of a human torso that looked like a charred tree stump was in the middle of the cellar. Near a pile of ashes in the corner lay a bag that disintegrated at the slightest touch. The bent metal handle and the keychain were all that remained. They were the bag and keys of my sister. That's where she always sat during the air raids. That's what my brother-in-law told me. Later, they even found a small piece of fabric from her dress. The firestorm, now back to the author, the firestorm created a different atmosphere, which was hostile to life in three ways. First, the heat climbed to almost 1,500 Fahrenheit in the area of the burning blocks of houses. Second, the wind blew at a velocity of 50 feet per second within a radius of 2.5 miles from the column of hot air. The thrust of this air current made it impossible to walk. Pedestrians braced themselves, were pulled down, and in the worst of cases were sucked into the fire source. Third, there was no oxygen. It was simply no longer possible to breathe the scorched, stalking air, reported Maria Lupus. This is what Maria reported. Because the maddening heat and oxygen deprivation threatened literally to dry us up, we helped each other climb down into the canal. The monstrous firestorm ripped the air right out of our mouths. Our survival instinct showed us the only way to find some oxygen was to breathe directly above the surface of the water. The child on my arm didn't budge. It was probably almost anesthetized from the fumes that had developed. Meanwhile, the lack of oxygen had also gotten worse down in the canal. The thick smoke penetrated painfully into eyes and lungs. You totally lost sense of time. Had many hours passed, or just a few? There were some horrific scenes at the river that flowed past the canal. Injured people washed ashore, who, in mortal fear, had jumped out of burning houses into the water. Many were already dead. Others had ghastly burns. There was dead silence everywhere. Back to the author. The 1,551 tons of bombs that rained down on the small jewelry and clock-producing city were a mighty load, 100 tons more than the Millennium raid on Cologne. Imagine. The 1,554 tons that fell 4 days later on Mainz, a city twice the size, killed 1,122 people. 2 years earlier, that was considered a dreadfully high figure. Now, during these concentrated attacks, it was merely average. But in Mainz, there was no firestorm. Harris had a plausible explanation. Rubble does not burn well. The heavy attacks on Mainz in September 1944 had created space. The firestorm needed close quarters, intact cities, buildings packed full with the essentials of life, furniture, clothing, food, books. Above all, there had to be enough roof frames and floorboards. It was for them that the hundreds of thousands of incendiary sticks were intended. Because Forsheim was small and irrelevant as regards armaments, Bomber Command had not damaged it much earlier in the war. Thus, the city's flammability had been preserved. Starting in the fall of 1944, Bomber Command's ability to place its incendiaries on the smallest possible, clearly defined area had been improved by the use of new cluster bombs. But the bombs needed combustibles. The smaller and more militarily insignificant the town, the better the target it had now become. The military value of Forsheim in February 1945 had grown immensely. This was due exclusively to its total military uselessness. Its attraction was the block-end buildings, the sandstone building material, the narrow and winding alleyways in the center, and the closely built row housing without proper firewalls. The city was virtually undefended, and fire protection was minimal. Master Bomber Swales could carry out his bombardment under laboratory conditions. It lasted from 7:50 p.m. to 8:12 p.m. That's 22 minutes. The typhoon did not get going until later, first with a strong air draft and then in the middle of the blaze. An ice-cold storm was sucked in, which needed until 11:30 p.m. to envelop the city in flames. Metal with a melting point of 3,100 degrees Fahrenheit became molten. After 22 minutes of work, Swales was shot down as he was leaving by a remaining German fighter plane, and Forsheim boiled into lava as if struck by the cyclopean fists of another geologic era. Well, I intended to stop there, and, look, it's only 8:27, according to my clock, so I have 2 more minutes, and I'm not going to continue further from that. That is the story of Forsheim. And so when they come up later with justification saying why they bombed these cities in 1945 after everything, you know, after the German war production had been brought to a halt, except for things that were underground, hidden places that they couldn't get at, then it's not true, because they're just trying to, once they got going, they didn't want to stop, obviously, but they also wanted to just flatten Germany and destroy as many Germans as possible. What happened in Dresden is just that. There's talk that they had some kind of manufacturing going on in Dresden. There were certain things happening. There were certain things that it would be good if they could destroy them, certain transportation centers and so on. But this is really not at all convincing. It's not even true. They just destroyed that magnificent city and all these other cities because they could. So we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, in about 5 minutes after this interesting news break, and I'll continue with my program.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
The U.S. and Britain have warned Israel not to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, urging diplomacy instead. Tehran, currently being visited by U.N. inspectors, denies accusations it's developing atomic weapons, saying its program is peaceful. But as RT's Irina Galushka reports from Tel Aviv, Israel could now be on an unstoppable path to a military strike.
Israel's leaders are actively drumming up the military rhetoric.
The Israeli government will continue to work hand in hand with the local security forces against such acts of terror, and we will continue to act against them forcefully, systematically, and calmly against international terror originating from Iran.
A potential Israeli-Iran clash looks more likely than ever. There is speculation a preemptive strike against Tehran's nuclear sites could happen as early as spring or summer, although that's not causing undue concern in Israel.
I think possibly people, you know, they make their plans for vacation, you know, Passover vacation, summer vacation. Possibly people are beginning to wonder, well, is there going to be a war? Is something going to mess it up? But I think they're probably going ahead with their vacation plans with sort of a thought in their back of their mind. It would be nice if we could get a flight that we could cancel, you know, it's that sort of thing.
Israel has previous experience when it comes to putting an end to nuclear ambitions, which pose a potential threat. In 1981, its jets wiped out reactors in Iraq. They struck again in 2007, hitting sites in Syria. But with Iran's nuclear program, things may not be so simple.
If Israel attacks Iran, it will not stop Iran forever from getting nuclear weapons. It will only postpone it for a relatively brief amount of time. The installations are too diverse and far-flung to destroy effectively. Israel does not have U.S. support.
A White House secretary advisor was in Tel Aviv over the weekend, warning against a move on Iran, saying it was better to wait for tougher sanctions to take effect in the coming months. But minds may already be made up.
I think one of the things that to create this aura of inevitability is to shut them up, to shut up opposition at home, and of course to convince the United States and Europe that this is an inevitability. It's going to happen. Don't oppose it. In fact, why don't you help us out?
There is a question mark, however, over whether Israel has what it takes to carry out the mission.
I doubt whether we have the capability of creating damages to the extent of annihilating the program.
And even if Israel's military prowess will allow it to carry out a strike on underground facilities in Iran, located some 1,600 miles away, chances are it won't end there.
Whereas, you know, Saddam Hussein and Bashar Assad, by the time they knew what was...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for staying with me. I have a couple of, I'm Carolyn Yeager. I should always repeat that so you know what you're listening to. This is the Heretics Hour on Voice of Reason. And we have, an hour and a half to go yet. So, I hope I can get all my topics in. Two things about, the bombing of Dresden memorialization that, I talked about last week. Of course, there's been a lot of happening on that, on the 13th and on the 14th in Germany. There's so much controversy about this bombing and how much, you know, that attention should not be put on it. But a couple of things that I think are very illuminating and the most interesting of what I've learned in the, during this week is one from my correspondent in Germany who keeps me informed about a lot of things. He is a member of the nationalist party. I guess he's a member of the party, but he's a nationalist. And he told me about a TV program. He said that on February 14th, the second anniversary day of the two-day Dresden bombing, a Jewess was given time on Germany's most prestigious late-night news program. In this 5-minute commentary portion that is called the Tagesthemen. I guess that's the name of the portion, but she used her 5 minutes to give her views on Dresden. Now, this was on the 14th, the second day of the commemoration of this, the day when there was, when the Allies bombed, Germany, Dresden. And, he said that, what she said was so disturbing to him. Her name was Esther Shapiro. And I want to tell you, he sent a YouTube video of it, and I watched it, but she's speaking in German. And she looks German, and she, I'm sure she's speaking perfect German. She's Jewish. And, I will try to link to this, YouTube video on my program page for this program. But just letting you know, it is in German, so. But she says, according to my friend, it was right to bomb Dresden. And this is the position of the Jews and of many, many of the, you know, all of the left wingers, the real super left, and even those who are just a little bit left, seems like, nowadays. It was right to bomb Dresden because Dresden was not demilitarized, as often proclaimed, she said, which is a lie. And then she said Dresden was an armed city too, an armament city, and had 8 KZ satellite camps. Well, I don't know. I keep hearing that mentioned now, but how big were these? What were these KZ satellite camps? KZ meaning concentration camp. Some tiny little place where some people were working on something. I don't know. I've never heard of them. But, that's not a, they didn't bomb those. You know, they bombed the inner city, as we know, and the civilians and the most historic part of the city. That's what they bombed. With the bombing of Dresden, Germany and Europe, she says on her commentary, was finally liberated. Now, what hogwash is that? This is what they're pushing. Then she goes on to say, but it's sad to see how today's neo-Nazis are abusing Dresden for their goals. And then he says she calls her comment, the myth of the pointless destruction of the innocent city of Dresden is wrong. So, you know, and then she repeats the lie of the 25,000 victims and says they were victims. She says they were 25,000 and no more. And she says they were victims of Nazi barbarism, too. So we can't, you know, they just cannot allow. And this is a concerted program. It's a campaign to minimize everything and to make the Germans really the perpetrators, as usual, and not the allies. They have to be vindicated because they make up that there was armaments in the city in some way, shape, or form, which has never been shown to be true. And they say that the pointless destruction of the innocent city of Dresden is a myth. It's a myth. It's wrong. It's not true. And he reminds me that, and you know, what I say is that no one says a word about this. You know, nobody complains because they don't dare. As he reminds me, this is the same network. It's the biggest network, he says, in that part of Germany, that Eva Herman was fired from. If anybody remembers Eva Herman, who said on a panel show, she simply said that Adolf Hitler had done some good things like the Autobahn, and there was such an uproar that she was fired, and she was beautiful and very, very popular, blonde German woman. Now, this woman gets on and says this, Esther Shapiro, nobody will open their mouth and complain about it, but it certainly hurts a German like the one who wrote to me because they can't defend the truth. And what's going on here is a perfect example, couldn't be a better example of falsification of history. And it's happening every day, every day. And with this Dresden business, little by little, you know, it's being changed in the public mind and people's minds. Even the fact that we have these pictures that show what happened, they don't even, they just say these lies anyway, and they have no. I'm going to talk a little bit later about this inability of Jews to deal with truth and reality and the way they handle it, which is very different from the way we handle it. All right. And another story that came from Germany this past week, which is a little more upbeat, is that there was a headline in a local Saxony newspaper that read something like opposition against Nazis in Germany is a punishable offense. This was supposed to be really shocking. You know, you're going to be punished for opposing the Nazis now in Germany. And it says dangerous signal for society. It's a story by Jacob Jung. And he writes, insofar as anyone in Germany will still discuss it or argue about it, that's how that discuss means, be they politician or authorities, they are blind in the right eye, asserts the Dresden City Attorney's Office, and the Immunity Committee of the Bundestag lays a very weighty argument on the scale that once more confirms the accusation. On the 9th of February, the Standing Committee has thrown the immunity of both the delegated representatives of Bundesfraktion of the Linkspartei, Karen Ley and Michael Leuter, out, and thereby left the way open for investigative proceedings due to disruption of a gathering. I don't know how this can be on the 9th of February because the march was on the 13th. But translation of all this is that the left, a couple of members of the left party, that's the Linke Party, Karen Ley and Michael Leuter, were a part of those protesters demonstrating against the peaceful marching and lawful marching of the nationalists who were doing their usual march in commemoration on February 13th. And they were blockaded and not allowed to continue. And a few of them were arrested, but most were not. But they prevented this peaceful demonstration, which had been legally allowed to continue. And because they think that they are so in the right and the others are so in the wrong that they are doing a great thing if they stop it. So if you listened, let's see what they said here. They said, did I get that down? They said that the people should be proud of them because, here it is. The media and the two deputies, these two people, who are going to lose their immunity for, you know, to, so that they won't have to face any kind of, but, you know, they don't have to face up to what they, to being a part of a public nuisance. They argue that democracy should be proud that they succeeded by a peaceful demonstration. Peaceful. They weren't peaceful. They were very non-peaceful, and they blockaded. They prevented this march from moving forward. The police couldn't even get them away. So the police had to turn the marchers back. So they were not able to complete their march. Anyway, they say democracy should be proud of them for obstructing this Dresden march. So they just take the law as they just fit the law to the idea that they are totally self-righteous. They're totally in the right, and anything opposite to them is wrong. And anybody who has different ideas about what happened at Dresden is wrong, and they shouldn't be allowed to say it. So this is the kind of lack of free speech that we have all over Europe, and that they want to enforce here in the United States. And this is one case where these people aren't getting away with it exactly, but I don't know how far this will go. But anyway, it's a good sign. It's a nice sign for a change. Well, I was going to talk now. I'm going to go into the next topic of Yalta under the heading of falsification of history. We have, everybody's familiar, I know you are, with how history has been falsified. And I know that you are familiar with George Orwell and the idea of how this how this takes place, how it's carried out, how it has been carried out, and how we are living in where many lies are considered to be truth, and truth is lies, and so on. Now, Yalta is a good example of that. And Yalta, the Yalta conference was in February 1945, and so it's not a bad time to talk about this. It was preceded by the Tehran conference in 1943, and it was followed by the Potsdam conference in July 1945. So when Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin met at Yalta, the main purpose was to determine how post-war Europe would be governed. They already knew they were going to win the war. It was just a matter of getting it finished and making the Germans surrender. So this was, because I say this was February 4th to 11th, 1945, when they were doing all this horrendous bombing of the German cities. And each leader had an agenda. Roosevelt asked for Soviet support in the U.S. Pacific War against Japan. That was his main interest at that time. His main desire was to get Russia or the Soviet Union to join the United States in the Pacific theater against Japan, which they currently had not gone to war against Japan. So I'll just continue the way I have it in my notes. Churchill was there mainly pressing for free elections and democratic governments in Eastern and Central Europe, specifically Poland, because he was under the dark cloud of having betrayed Poland. And now he was trying to make good on it and make sure that the Poles weren't going to, he wasn't going to be look like the bad guy forever, which he has, though. And then Stalin was there demanding a Soviet sphere of political influence in Eastern and Central Europe. He just wanted to expand his control over Europe as far as he could. And it was called their national security strategy. And Churchill, Carey said that. Now, some points of interest here is that Poland had served as a historical corridor for forces attempting to invade Russia. This was how Stalin argued this. He said, Poland, has been, you know, a threat to our security, trying to invade us at different times. And he says, but then he also threw in that the Russians had sinned against Poland, and so that he, as the Soviet head of government, was going to wanted to atone for those sins. And Roosevelt fell for this, and Churchill kind of fell for it too. They thought, well, maybe he's going to do right by Poland. He threw that in there so that they would go along with his demands. And Stalin said that the Polish government in exile demands were not negotiable. That is, he was not going to negotiate with the Poles and their government in exile. And they would, he had already decided that the Soviet Union was going to keep the territory of Eastern Poland that they had already annexed in 1939. And Poland would be compensated for that by extending its western borders at the expense of Germany. And we know that Poland took over all that Eastern German land and still has it today. So, and then Stalin promised free elections in Poland, despite the fact that they had recently installed a provisional government there, a Soviet provisional government. So he was telling a lot of lies. But the others, well, here we have this question about what kind of leaders Churchill and Roosevelt were. Churchill was now in realizing that he was in a begging position with the Soviet Union and also with the United States. He held no cards. He had nothing to bargain with. And he had spent everything in his mad pursuit of enforcing a defeat on Germany and Hitler is what I would say. And now he was just there trying to act like he was one of the big three, but he really, nobody cared what he said. Now, Roosevelt, as I said, wanted Stalin to enter the Pacific War. And in order to get him to agree to that, he gave away Manchuria and other Chinese interests to the USSR without the consent of China. Stalin then said that the only agreement he gave was to enter the Pacific War 3 months after the defeat of Germany, which hadn't occurred yet, of course. So he said, after Germany is defeated, then in 3 months' time, I will go to war against Japan. If you're still at war in Japan, I don't think they were. I don't think he did it. It had to do anything. But anyway, the Yalta agreements were actually a sellout to Soviet expansion, both east and west. Now, why was Stalin in the key bargaining position and the king, so to speak, of that conference when they were supposed to be on an equal basis? Well, what came up, let me see, I've got that a little further down here, but what we have is that Churchill and Roosevelt were both washed up and washed out and done in by then. You know, Churchill had, as I said, expended everything that he had going for him, but Roosevelt had gotten ill. And he was never very good anyway, because in 1943, Roosevelt, this is a famous statement a lot of you will know, he replied to his ambassador to the Soviet Union, Bill Bullitt Jr., as to his rationale for relations with Stalin. He said to his Soviet ambassador when they were talking, "I just have a hunch that Stalin is not that kind of a man." I guess the kind of a man that Bullitt was saying he was. "And I think that if I give him everything I possibly can and ask for nothing from him in return, noblesse oblige, he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of democracy and peace." Now, this is what he said in 1943. He was obviously greatly under the influence of his Jewish advisors and not a very smart man or not caring. He just wasn't caring much about his own country. This goes back to President's Day. These kind of presidents should not be honored. These presidents need to be looked at. We should have a day to criticize. I don't know. We should have a day to do something besides just honor every president because he was a president. Anyway, then by 1945, in February 1945, He was not in a position to even hardly know what was going on, and he still had this great idea of Joseph Stalin as being a good man, and he wanted to get on with the, he wanted Stalin to go along with the UN. He had all these interests that came before what he should have been interested in. So on March 1st, 1945, Roosevelt assured Congress shortly after the Yalta conference. He says, "I come from the Crimea with the firm belief that we have made a start on the road to a world of peace." And all they did was give Stalin everything he wanted. So by March 21st, Roosevelt's ambassador to the USSR, and another one, Averell Harriman, cabled him, after he had said that to Congress, that we must come clearly to realize that the Soviet program is the establishment of totalitarianism, ending personal liberty and democracy as we know it. And 2 days later, Roosevelt began to admit that his view of Stalin had been excessively optimistic and that Averill is right. Well, we know he died not too long after that. So whether he was in his right mind or not is questionable. He didn't have much of a mind left. But the main point of the Yalta conference and the Yalta agreement for me and in history is the unconditional surrender demand. They agreed that they would demand unconditional surrender from both Germany and Japan, and this gave the green light to continued punishment of civilians, because they had to force the morale down so that they would have to capitulate, and they had to get rid of every possible civilian defense and so on. And they wanted a country that they could totally control when they took it over. Also, they didn't want any difficulties with Germans who didn't like what they wanted to do there. So all of this is not the kind of history that we are taught, although we can find it. It can be found in history. I mean, it's even on the Wikipedia pages, but it still is not the general view that is taken. The general view that is taken is still that this was a good war against a bad enemy, Adolf Hitler and Germany, and that everything that was done in some way or another had to be done. Now, Churchill and Roosevelt were both vain, mediocre men who had personality, they had charisma, they had confidence, they had above-average speaking ability. And I'm saying, you know, this president we have now, Barack Obama, is the same type, only he's of a low, even lower quality than they were. But and they also had Jewish friends, both Churchill and Roosevelt and Obama. But, I mean, they're not great men. They're not great men, but they somehow became in charge of the wealthiest nations of the time, and they are able to do untold damage to hundreds of millions of people under their influence. They are the culprits of 20th century history, none other. I mean, if history was what it should be, they would be the ones who we would be pointing at. They would be the ones who we would be hating, and rightly so, not Adolf Hitler. You know, Stalin and Roosevelt joined up Churchill and Roosevelt joined up with Stalin already in 1939. As Stalin already had mountains of blood on his hands. He didn't, there was nothing good you could say about him. But they had decided that they wanted to destroy Germany and Adolf Hitler, so they joined with Stalin and the Soviet Union and the communists to do it. And they joined with the Jews to do it. So this is what took place, much to the harm of all Europeans, and almost probably you could say everybody in the world, but mostly to us, and it's still going on. And so this falsification of history should be undone. It's starting to be. I was very happy to see that Mark Weber did a program last week on VOR a new book out on Adolf Hitler. And I think once this is really starting to take hold. I said this a year or more ago, that the view of Hitler was changing. It was going to change. And once it really got going, there was no stopping it. And I think, even though the resistance against it is, going to get fierce, I think there's no stopping it. And because the facts are there and they're becoming clearer, and Roosevelt and Churchill do not have they don't have the magic that they did have. It's quickly so truth is coming out, but we're going to get more into why truth has such a hard time in the second half. Right now, I would like to give a quote from Bill Bonner, of all people, who I read a few columns again, caught up on him a little bit, on the war in Afghanistan, and he has some interesting things now and then. He says a friend of a friend. He had this little anecdote. A doctor in the Army Reserves just returned from Afghanistan, and he said, it was such a waste. It was so expensive keeping us all there. Most of the time, we did nothing. Then we would go on patrol. The Afghanis would try to kill us. We'd try to kill them. And they were just drug dealers and goat herds. What was the point? He said, he was a medical doctor there. I'd get two kinds of patients, those who had just stepped on a landmine and lost a leg, and those who had injured themselves playing football in our camp. Both were a waste. Well, you know, this is just more of the same of what was going on in World War II. War going on for somebody's benefit, and if we would look closely enough at it, and we really should be doing more about it. All right, we're at our 1 hour break time, so I will be back. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour. Be back.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Eurozone finance ministers have been meeting in Brussels to decide on a new bailout package for Greece. Ahead of the meeting, several governments signalled they would support the €130 billion deal, providing Athens meets all conditions set out by the EU and the IMF. The past weeks have seen growing uncertainty over Greece, with talk the country could default on its debts and be forced to leave the Eurozone. Eurogroup chairman Jean-Claude Juncker said he was confident a package would be agreed on Monday and said default would not be a solution.
It is the intention of nobody to have Greece outside the euro area. This would be a bad solution for Greece, and it would be nonetheless bad situation for the euro area.
There has been some confusion over how Greece meets demands for extra cuts worth €325 million, which were set as a precondition by the EU and the IMF. European Commission spokesman Amadeo Altafaj.
I'm sure that the Greek authorities will be explaining that in detail, since it is their budget. Therefore, it is first and foremost to the Greek authorities to explain how they will cover the fiscal gap.
And our Europe editor Vanessa Mock says Greece has been straining to satisfy the EU and the IMF.
The government has already pushed through a massive austerity and reform package, and it's now rushing through two more pieces of emergency legislation, including wage and pension cuts. That's in order to satisfy demands by the EU, the IMF and the European Central Bank. In France, Finance Minister François Baroin said the political commitments had now been made to save Greece. But in Brussels, diplomats have warned that the package will not resolve Greece's economic problems. That could take up to a decade or more, and the worsening downturn could continue to test the will of Greece's political leaders and of the Greeks themselves. Vanessa Mock, Brussels.
For breaking updates on the Greek bailout and the euro crisis, follow us on Twitter. In other news, Iran has announced it will hold military exercises to boost protection of its nuclear sites. A statement from the military said drills would be held in the south of the country. There's been mounting speculation that Israel may attack Iran's nuclear facilities. There's been chaos on the River Danube in the Serbian capital Belgrade, caused by a rapid thaw which saw ice damaging boats, pontoons and floating restaurants. The official newspaper of the Chinese Communist Party has accused the West of provoking a civil war in Syria. In a front-page commentary, the People's Daily says Western support of Syria's opposition would lead to large-scale civil war. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and this is the Heretics Hour, and I am continuing with the falsification of history. I have two more topics I'd like to cover, but I want to invite you to call in. This is my call-in time, my taking phone calls time, and the number is 1-855-477-2283. Now, I got an email several weeks ago, and I've been questioning some Karl Mayer propaganda about Adolf Hitler, and I wanted to answer it, but I never had time to do it in any of the shows since then. But I've found time tonight, so I'm gonna cover that. It's quite interesting. A listener sent me this page from the internet by Mark Hughes at UCSB EDU faculty, Mark Hughes projects, Hitler, and then some pages. And he wanted to know from things like this that he has read, he said, this is the one he used as an example, how we should view information like this about Hitler's early associations with Jews and or Reds, other words, the communists. And, going to the website, this is the website of Harold Marcuse, who is the son of the Frankfurt School notable Jew Herbert Marcuse. Harold, unfortunately, because of his father's fame, has gotten a position as associate professor of history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. So he gets to live in that beautiful city of Santa Barbara, and have a, you know, probably a very easy history position there, and get paid well, and do all his propaganda, all his Jewish propaganda against the truth. So this is I told the emailer that this is the enemy, and this is enemy propaganda, and that's how he should view it. But then I went on to explain some things, and what was convincing on this page that Harold Marcuse has put up is a quote from Ian Kershaw in his 1998 book, Hitler. It's part of his multi-book biography. This one is the first one, I guess. Yes, Hitler, 1899-1936, Hubris. And he's on page 122 of this book. He writes, in 1919, his Karl Mayer, that's Mayer is spelled M-A-Y-R, but it's pronounced like Mayer, and he was the one who hired, who was the boss, you might say, or the officer that hired Hitler right when he got, after he got back from the war, was in the barracks in Munich to work for them in undercover for looking for traitors and so on and communists after they had defeated the communists. So there was this, I think this will come up in the discussion here if you're confused about it. But this is in 19, this is what Ian Kershaw, well-known British historian, wrote in 1998. He said in 1919, his, Karl Mayer's, influence in the Munich Reichswehr extended beyond his rank as captain, and he was endowed with considerable funds to build up a team of agents or informants, organize a series of educational courses to train selected officers and men in correct political and ideological thinking. This is now the right wing, the conservatives, the anti-communists, and finance patriotic parties, publications, and organizations. Mayer first met Hitler in May 1919, after the crushing of the Red Army. Hitler's involvement in his battalion's investigations into subversive actions during the Ratter Republic, that's the Red Republic, or otherwise known as the Bavarian Soviet Republic or the Munich Soviet Republic. That was the one that was there temporarily when they defeated, you know, they took over and in a kind of a revolution in Bavaria, and it didn't last too long. Anyway, in fact, only lasts a few months. Mayer first met, Hitler's involvement. Now, here's the important part. Hitler's involvement in his battalion's investigations into subversive actions during the Weimar Republic may have drawn him to Mayer's attention. As we have noted, Hitler had already been engaged in propaganda work in his barracks earlier in the spring, though on behalf of the socialist government. Well, you see, this is false, but this is what Kershaw wrote in 1998, which he changed when he came out with his newest book, Hitler, A Biography, in 2008. Well, he has another book since then, but this was the 2008 Hitler, A Biography. And I'm going to read that in a minute. But, you know, this is where they put up something by a historian like Kershaw. And if he says something, well, it's supposed to be, you know, just gospel truth. Nobody questions. This person doesn't question. Mark Hughes sets it up like you don't question what he has said here, that Hitler was working on behalf of the socialist government. Well, he wasn't. He was elected by his barracks mates, that is, his fellow soldiers in the barracks, to be their representative in required meetings with the government, which at that time was socialist. And so he was the representative, their representative, to the socialist meeting, government meetings, which was a requirement because the socialist regime was the government at the time. And he was elected to this because his fellow soldiers trusted him to represent their interests, and they were not communists. Now, Ian Kershaw, in this new biography in 2008, he writes this on page 71, quite different from before. Significant is that within a week of the end of the rule of the councils, Hitler had been nominated to serve on a three-man committee to explore whether members of his battalion had been actively involved in the Weimar Republic or Red Republic. This speaks in favor of the recognition within his battalion of his deep antagonism to Red rule. This prevented him from being discharged with the rest of the Munich garrison at the end of May 1919. And he goes on to say, between December 1918 and March 1919, Hitler worked at a, well, that's, I think that's me giving some background information. Okay, let's just take this for now. So here you have Kershaw changing his view in 2008 from what he had written in 1998, 10 years before. But people can just come along. And post this because it hasn't been taken out, or I don't know what historians do when they update their their views and they change their mind from one book to the next. But in any case, you can post this and say, well, this is what he said. This is Ian Kershaw. He's an important historian. And ignore the later one, which is what this Mark Hughes did. He didn't have this later one posted because he is not trying to give history. Here we have, again, the falsification of history. He's a professor of history at the University of California, but he's only an associate professor. Good. But he is not trying to present true history. He's presenting propaganda purely. And that's it. Now, to give some background on Hitler at this time, which is always brought up when they want to defame him and say that he was working with the communists. And then from that, you see, he was working with the Jews and then the Zionists. He was a Jew, or at least he was on the side of the Zionists. And that's all, we see that played out after he became chancellor and he created the Jews to Palestine, program and so on. And all this is used in order to put forth an absolutely wrong picture of Adolf Hitler. It's done on purpose, I think, but the people who do it do not want to ever hear you try to explain to them why they're wrong about that. They just will not listen to it. They're not interested because they're not interested in true history. They're only interested in propaganda. Now, what happened there was between December 1918 and March 1919, Hitler worked at a prisoner of war camp at Traustein with his friend Schmidt. They had been in the Munich barracks, and then they got an opportunity to go to Traustein and do this job because there was nothing much to do in the Munich barracks. And so they went and did that, and then they returned again to Munich. And shortly after his return, he witnessed a takeover bid by local communists who seized power before being ousted by the army. After he gave evidence at an investigation into the takeover, he was asked to become part of a local army organization, which was responsible for persuading returning soldiers not to turn to communism or pacifism. This was the one with Karl Mayer. During his training for this task and during his subsequent duties, he was able to hone his oratory skills. As part of his duties, he was also asked to spy on certain local political groups to see if they, you know, had any of these communists in them who were trying to take over or whatever. And during the meeting of the German Workers' Party that he went to, as, you know, in that capacity to check it out, he became so incensed by one of the speeches by somebody there that he delivered a fierce harangue to the speaker. And the founder of the party, Anton Drexler, who I guess this speaker wasn't exactly of the same thoughts as the founders of the party, Anton Drexler was so impressed by Hitler's tirade that he asked him to join their organization. And that's a kind of a well-known story. And Hitler didn't do it right away, but after some thought, he decided, okay, he was going to leave the army and he was going to go into politics, and he would start with this party. This party was here. He liked their beliefs and their program, and he would just join that. And of course, he kind of took over, but they let him because he was so superior to anything that they had going. So after he joined their main committee there in their party, and he became the seventh official. That was in September 1919, and that's where he started his political career. But the other thing interesting about this Marcuse page that shows that it's pure propaganda is that he shows the actual story from a newspaper. It was in a publication in England in 1941. It was published. Just think, 1941 is the war. You know, the war is going on. This is where the British intelligence operations were going on in the United States prior to the December, the Pearl Harbor thing, when they didn't need to do it anymore. But they were in the United States, and they were undercover doing all kinds of pro-war propaganda with the consent of the President Roosevelt, or he just looked the other way. Everybody looked the other way. And they were doing that, and they were putting out all kinds of propaganda. I mean, all kinds of black ops and so on. And so this paper, this article was in this British paper in 1941 by an anonymous author. And the title of it was, "I Was Hitler's Boss." And it says it was, the byline was, "A Former Officer of the Reichswehr." No name. But, of course, we're supposed to know that that's got to be Karl Mayer. So this is supposed to be written by Karl Mayer. But it really is not. It's a British intelligence disinformation project in which truth is mixed with untruth. And so he tells a story in there about how he met Adolf Hitler, this Reichswehr officer, and he went to work for him. And then he says these nasty things that nobody liked Hitler. Everybody kind of despised him, and that, what was it? He never changed his clothes or something like that, you know, and he never did this or that. He was just this kind of scummy person, but he was a very good orator. So they used him, and it's disgusting, you know, and this is on this, page by this history professor, Harold Marcuse, the son of Herbert Marcuse, the Frankfurt schooler. Now, this is the kind of thing that people run into. And this person who emailed me, he ran into this, And he said, what am I supposed to think about this? Well, I would hope that he could see through this. But if you don't know enough of the background, it's amazing how people are convinced when they see this stuff down in black and white, they're convinced that, well, there must be some truth to this. Well, there isn't. So you've got to kind of have an understanding of what is true and what is false to begin with. And then when you see stuff that stinks like this, you can recognize that it smells and you need to look at it very critically. And as soon as you find out that this is by, that this whole business is all by this Harold, Harold Marcuse, and all the rest of his pages that he's got there, which are all very typical Jewish propaganda, then you should be able to see. But anyway, I'm glad I was able to cover this. I hope that writer was listening tonight or will listen, and that this will be one more little contribution to the against the myths about Adolf Hitler that we should be able to see through. Okay, I'm going to go on to my Elie Wiesel latest article, but I've got a caller, so I'm going to ask the caller to identify himself and see what he says. Hello, caller.
Good evening, Carolyn. This is Rodney calling from California.
Hi, Rodney.
Hi. I'm really enjoying your program. You're talking about correcting history, and I thought I'd share just a brief line. One of the issues with, the German National Socialist government that has been so maligned and lied about has been the topic of the National Socialist, or, racial policies that were put in effect in Germany, particularly those were put in effect in 1936. And, it's hard work for people to actually separate fact and fiction. And, there's been a lot of words that have been put in National Socialist mouths. The term master race and things of that nature, and race haters and such. And I recently have been dealing with health issues and been catching up on my reading, and I decided to do a lot of reading of original sources and authors and speeches and policies and such. I can share with you just a brief line because it goes to this narrative, this Jewish narrative, this Marxist narrative, and I've long said, and you're correct, that eventually the pendulum would swing back because people will only take a mouthful of sewage for so long. And that's why I think the narrative is changing. People beginning to, like the recent author who wrote the new book on Hitler in a completely different perspective. He basically took all of the a lot of the information and data that has been purposely omitted by other authors. And I think we need to understand that authors like Evans and such, are basically authors with an agenda, and that you're never going to get any truth from them. But getting back to this narrative about the race policies, there was a National Socialist physician, very well-educated physician. His name was Gerhard Wagner, and no relation, I believe, to the famous Richard Wagner, but anyway, he was a physician, and he worked in the NSDAP's Office of Race and Medical Science, and he developed a lot and contributed to a lot of the racial policies, and he spoke at all of the party congresses, even up to the – he missed the last one in 1938 because he passed away in 1938. But he spoke to all of them, and he was always spoke to capacity crowds, because he was a very articulate speaker and was and spoke to the crust of the issue, not in scientific terms. But he gave a speech at the 1936 Party Congress, where the Nuremberg decrees and such were actually introduced. And he made a couple of statements that I think are relevant. He said, "People are always saying that our National Socialist racial thinking is materialistic, unchristian, chauvinistic, imperialist, and imperialistic, and that leads to the defamation of foreign races and peoples. The opposite is the case. We believe that our racial policy is the surest guarantee for mutual respect and the peaceful coexistence between peoples of this world. Someone of another race is different from both for me in both body and soul, for both are important. This makes no value judgment about other races. We, too, are conscious of the relationship between our own blood and value our own blood and our own race to presume to make such a judgment. He then goes on to talk about that there are clearly racial differences and that purposely mixing the races does a disservice to both. And we've seen the horrible, horrible results of miscegenation and bringing in, say, the Arab populations into Europe today.
Yeah.
Bringing in the mestizo and the African populations in the United States.
It's true, Rodney. This is a little bit off what I'm talking about tonight. It's not a real good fit. But I thank you for that. And we'll talk about that next week when you come on the program.
That's not what people say that National Socialism was about. And actually, it is correct. I really enjoy your show tonight. You're really hitting another part.
Okay, thanks, Rodney.
Take care.
We could talk about the racial issue on and on, and we are going to talk about that next week, and Rodney's going to be my guest next week. So I'm looking forward to that, and that's a little heads up for you all. Now, I'm going to go into I do very much want to talk about my latest Elie Wiesel Cons the World article, because it's very important in my estimation, and it has a lot to do with falsification of history. I mean, we think in terms of the big people in history, but and Elie Wiesel is definitely not a big person. How does he fit into history? Well, really, he doesn't, in my estimation. He's a nobody. He's a nobody, but he's become somebody in this crazy modern age of ours, post-World War II, when the Jews were given the kind of the keys to the kingdom, you know, and were allowed to just have everything and do everything, and nobody could say a word about, you know, about what they were doing. And this is how people like Elie Wiesel became a somebody. So he came of age during the rise of the Jewish people, and grabbed hold of took a chance in the concentration camp literature craze that was building momentum, and he cashed in big. He just happened to get it just right, or the right things came about at the right time. But the fact is, he is known to be an ambitious person to those who know him. So I think he worked pretty hard at succeeding at what he was doing. And so when I said before that he just happened to, things just happened right for him, is part of that publicity that's put out, that public personality he pretends to. I can fall for that too while I'm just talking about it. Like, oh, he was just lucky. Well, I think that he had a bit of planning going on in all of this, but none of us can say just how or what or why, because he's a very mysterious character, and he keeps there's a lot of unknown about him. He puts out this story about his life and who he is and his family and so on and what happened. And the facts don't always add up. What is said doesn't add up, but nobody cares, and nobody will look into it, and nobody will question it because of the power that supports him. So I'm going to start out before the break with this little business between that's so famous about Elie saying, you know, that some things are true that never happened. And in the long story of it, he goes to visit this Hasidic Rebbe, which is really what we call a rabbi, but they called a Rebbe. He's a rabbi that he greatly admires and looks up to, and he's traveling or something, and he comes to where this rabbi is, and he goes to see him. And the rabbi asks him what he's writing about or what he's doing, or I don't know. And he says he's writing some things. He says, what are you writing about? And Elie says, well, I'm writing about some things that might have happened. And Rebbe is suspicious right away. And he says, and there may have been a few more words there, but Rebbe says, you're writing lies. And Elie, knowing that he is embarrassed, doesn't quite know what to say, doesn't want the Rebbe to think badly of him, but he's not going to give in, or he's not going to give up what he's doing, or he's not going to come clean or anything either. So he comes up with this answer, and he says that, and the famous quote is something like, in literature, Rebbe, he's teaching the Rebbe about literature, which is different from life. Some things are true, though they never happened, and things that did happen are not true. Now the Rebbe, and then he put that in a couple different ways, but the Rebbe didn't look too pleased, but he finally got over it, and because Eliezer was a good Jew, and they parted company in a good way. But this is how Jews look at truth and reality, and we'll go into that more when we come back from this break. Stay with me.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Eurozone's austerity drive has also hit Spain, as tens of thousands of people have marched out across the country today. Protesters are angry at the government's labor reforms. They say reforms were unfair to workers and would destroy jobs. The changes make it easier to adjust employee schedules and wages and have staff fired. Let's now talk to Patrick Young. He's Executive Director of investment advisory firm DV Advisors. Spain's unemployment is already the highest in the Eurozone, and trade unions are saying the new reforms will only make things worse, making it easier for companies to fire people. So, Patrick, who are these laws designed to help? People or corporations?
I think ultimately the laws are actually designed to try and help the Spanish economy, because you see, in essence, both parties are right. The corporations are right. They can't manage to fire anybody. They've got incredibly stringent employment contracts. The unions at the same time, well, they're defending a particular constituency. And the constituency is essentially people who are predominantly 30 plus years old, all the way up to pensionable age, because those are the only people who can get permanent contracts in Spain. And this is where the disingenuity of this argument arises, because the tragedy is, and the reason why Spain has got 40% unemployment amongst those people who are in their 20s, is simply because they cannot get a permanent job. Because frankly, when you employ somebody permanently in Spain, you are conjoined with that employee more or less through eternity. Now this leads us to the terrible crux of capitalism, which is always a problem, but ultimately works, which is what we call Schumpeter's creative destruction. The point is, sometimes you have to get rid of people in certain jobs in order to employ people in other places. And actually, a very good example of how that worked was in the United Kingdom, going nowhere in the 1970s. By the time Mrs. Thatcher had finished, there was a country that was actually back on the verge of the Premier League once again. So, in essence, Spain needs to reform. The government is right, but that doesn't mean it's not going to be potentially painful for a lot of people who do have jobs at the moment.
You talk about those people under 30 being hard hit in Spain and no doubt throughout the Eurozone. Austerity measures, they cut jobs, don't they? Not actually create them. So that's certainly not one measure to pursue, is it?
Well, look, the point about austerity is this. I mean, as we all know, when you get to the point where the government employs 100% of the workforce, that doesn't matter. It doesn't work. It doesn't function. In fact, it's totally dysfunctional, as we all know, from Russia's rather unfortunate experiment up until about 1990. The issue here is effectively the fact that we must live within our means. We must have reasonable budgeting, and companies must have an opportunity to employ people. And actually, I would argue that in a certain sense, some countries have become completely farcical, because actually, the public sector, the government, is giving such better employment prospects to people that the private sector, the entrepreneurs, the people who create the wealth, actually can't manage to hire anybody in the first place because they can't afford to pay the wages.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Well, hello again, ladies and gentlemen. I am back for the last half hour with you, and the call-in number is 1-855-477-2283. If you have a comment or something to do with what I'm talking about here, and that I will take it. Sometimes I know I seem like I don't really want the calls, but I do. I'm just anxious to get to get on to some of this information that I have prepared. So I'm going to start in again talking about truth and reality as it has to do with Jews and how Jews look at it. I'm not going to apologize for using the word Jews as a, you know, general painting with a broad brush, because I think it applies in so many cases. So, you know, the idea that they have is what you believe, or you can make others believe, is what the truth and reality is. Very different. It's, if all the Jews agree on what the Holocaust was, then that makes it true. I mean, that's how they think. If they agree on it, or if they all say, then that, it's not about forensic information. It's not about this kind of, you know, evidential reality. It's about perceptions. And you hear Jewish people all the time, well-known ones, saying that they don't care about what happened here or there, but what they care about is how it's perceived, what people's perceptions are. That's how they think. And these people are excellent lawyers, as we know. They're shysters, they're criminals. They're also theater people, though, excellent in the theater. They're actors, directors, stage managers, what have you. And so what I'm saying is that they determine what history is, and they've been doing it for their entire history. They don't learn it from historical sources. They say, you know, we create the historical sources. We create our history. You know, Churchill did the same thing. He said, history is going to be very kind to me because I'm going to write it. So this is, you know, he had that same kind of thinking. He got himself so Judaized eventually, Churchill, that he may as well have been one, whether he actually had Jewish blood in him or not. But I say it makes these people dangerous. You know, it's in the sense that George Orwell wrote about. And I'm going to give you some examples from this latest article of mine now. And it is titled Night One and Night Two, What Changes Were Made and Why, Part One. It's on the Elie Wiesel Cons the World website. You can get there by going to ElieWieselTattoo.com. And why this article is important is because with the translator, somebody's on the line here, or somebody's, I'm hearing somebody a little bit in the background. I think the line should be closed. A translator, I was lucky enough to get the help of a translator who could translate the Yiddish book that Night was taken from. And for those of you who might need a little background here, Elie Wiesel's book Night is what his entire reputation rests on. All the other books that he's written, if he had not written Night, would not have made any impression. He would not be the well-known personage that he is. No way. I mean, it's all due to that one book, Night. Now, this book was first written in Yiddish, and I've been aware of it for a long time, but I didn't know what it said. Would you please close the line, Mike? Would you close the line that's open, that you're on, I guess? I did not know what it said, so I was trying to figure out, you know, Ellie's story of how he wrote that book is so ridiculous that I thought, well, he never wrote it. He's making it up. And I still don't know whether he wrote it. I'm not convinced that he wrote it, because he tells such a silly story about how he did it, how it was written. But anyway, it was very long originally, but when it was published in 19, just to make this shorter, it was published in, he wrote it in 1954, supposedly, on a boat on the way to South America. And there he met a publisher who published Jewish Holocaust stories. And he turned it over to this publisher without having a copy of it. He turned over his only copy to him. And this man who was Jewish published it as part of an anthology in 1955. And then it came out in an individual book at the end of 1955, and it had a 1956 copyright date on it. And this book, a copy of this book, was mailed to Elie Wiesel in Paris. You know, he came back to Paris, of course, after a few months in South America, in December 1955, according to Elie Wiesel's memoir. And the book says, it's all in Yiddish. It's the title is Undivelt Hot Geschwind, and it is, which means, and the world remained silent, or the world remained quiet. It means the world didn't say anything. The book had the author as Elisar Wiesel. But it didn't have any, not one word of information about this Elisar Wiesel. Not one word of a biographical information. Nothing about how the book was written, who, why, what. It was just Elisar Wiesel was the author, and then the story. Now I have a translator for the website, and, He has translated large portions of this book in Yiddish. Yes, he can translate Yiddish. He's very good at it. And we've got the parts, the same parts in French from the French edition, because once Elie Wiesel got this book, this Yiddish book in the mail that supposedly he wrote, and it had been edited down quite a bit, and it was now 245 pages in this book. Then he supposedly, because he had talked to a famous French writer, he had edited some more and written it in French, translated it into French in a much shorter version, and then he sent that to Paris. He was living in the United States now, and he sent it to this François Mauriac, a famous writer in Paris, who he had become friends with, who had befriended him. And François Mauriac finally found a publisher. And then the book was published. They cut it down some more. The publisher mainly cut it down some more and published it under the title Night, or in French, La Nuit. So La Nuit, the French version, was the one that Elie Wiesel wrote from his Yiddish version. This is his story. And then the French version was translated into English. And that's how it remained until 2006, when a new translation came out by Elie Wiesel's wife, Marion Wiesel. Now, the point is that what we found is, now having the actual Yiddish translation, it turns out that it's very close to the French translation, and the English translation by Stella Rodway is very, very exactly the same as the French translation. So she did a very good job of turning it into English from the French. And so we have all of this, and it's all very much the same, except that there's a lot more in the Yiddish version, because it's twice as long as the La Nuit and Night once they were edited down. So it says a lot more, but it pretty much says the same, except what we find is that in 2006, when Marion Wiesel did a new translation, she made some very interesting changes, which were necessary to make for the Night going on into the future without any too much controversy about things that are in it that don't add up to Elie Wiesel being able to be in Auschwitz or in Buchenwald as he claims to be. Now, I have written many articles already on this website, which show that that there is no proof, no evidence whatsoever that for Elie Wiesel and his father being at either Auschwitz, Monowitz, or later on at Buchenwald. The only thing there is Elie Wiesel saying so and other people saying so, but there is nothing hard to point to. Now they came up with the fact that he was in this photograph. I don't want to go into that because I've written about that so much, but I have shown that he is not the person in that photograph at Buchenwald, although mainstream, it's still going on that's him in that photograph. They did this. They said it was him in order to give some evidence that he was actually there. But this doesn't pan out. So we don't have any. Now, what we find in comparing these four books, once again, the Yiddish, the French, the English, for the first English translation, and then the second one by his wife, Marion, what we find is that the problems that are in the book, in which the person who wrote it, whoever that person is, the original book, didn't have the facts. The facts that are given don't fit with the fact that when the Hungarian deportation took place, when they arrived at Auschwitz, when that number, that famous registration number A7713, that Elie Wiesel says is his number and is tattooed on his arm, although we've never seen it, and we have pictures of his left arm, quite a lot of them, and there's no tattoo seen there. There's never been any tattoo seen on his arm, but he still says it's there. So these kinds of lies, which you see, we can relate back to the fact that his being brought up as a Hasidic Orthodox Jew and really deep into the Jewish thinking and Jewish traditions, he seems to be someone who, if he says it's true, and if all these other Jews and all these other important people who cater to the Jews, which is most everybody today in important positions, agree that he does, then that's good enough, right? And so he doesn't worry about it. He continues to say, like he's got that tattoo, he continues to say he was transported to Auschwitz with his family, even though the dates and the times and the description and so on in his book Night don't fit the reality of the Hungarian deportation to this camp. And other things are kind of odd, but in this article I'm only dealing with the differences between the original English translation and Marion Wiesel's translation. And we find that she has made changes to make it fit, to make Elie Wiesel fit. She's changed his age. She's changed the age of the narrator of the book, whose name is Elisar. She's changed the times, the number, the length of transports, the times when they took the transport, the dates. She's changed the names of months. She's changed that's basically it. The ages, she's changed ages, and she's changed dates, and she's changed the number of days that it took to get from one place to another, which is said, for example, something very important that we discovered just towards the end, just recent, not too long ago, was this 10 days and 10 nights that already when they were going to, when they were transported to Buchenwald. And Elie Wiesel and his father definitely were not in Buchenwald. But anyway, they say they were. He says they were. He says in the Yiddish book, it says very clearly that the trip to Buchenwald was 10 days and 10 nights. And he describes a lot of what went on. It's a very detailed account, in a sense for him, of those days. And then, of course, the French followed that in 10 days and 10 nights. And Stella Rodway, in her English translation, followed that 10 days and 10 nights. But 10 days and 10 nights of traveling to Buchenwald from Gleiwitz, where they started on the train, makes Elie Wiesel get, it makes this trainload of Jews not get to Buchenwald until February 1st. And in night, Elisar's father dies on January 28th, and the night of January 28th, 29th. And they've already been there going on 2 weeks, according to his, you know, all the stuff that he's written there. So, either he has to say that night is not an autobiography, or he has to say that, he has to do something because he insists that everything in there is true and that's just the way it was. And so, Marion Wiesel has been trying in her new translation to clean that stuff up so that it can be his autobiography rather than a novel. And of course, I make the point in this article too that Night was a novel when it first came out. And I made the point when I was talking about his story about what's true and what's false and what could happen, you know, some things happen that aren't true, that he said to the Rebbe, in literature, some things are true. And, you know, in the original English version of Night that I have a picture of in this article, and I have the book, too, it's a hardcover with a black and white cover. And on the back, it says that the book is classified as literature. It's written right there. And, of course, it's good to have that, but it's been described as a novel for a long time, and then suddenly it became an autobiography. So, you know, they're trying to, this is where it comes into falsifying history. They're, as I wrote in a comment recently about this, as I was talking about this article, they have Elie Wiesel scheduled to be the great saint of the Holy Order of Holocaust. And, you know, they're cleaning everything up as best they can, and they're making the book Night and the actual story of his life, in those years, and what he went through, which really is not true, because he has become so popular and so huge, and they got the Nobel Prize for him, and that helps too. So he's it. And they've got everything. They've got him as the main character for the future, indefinite future of Holocaustianity, that Elie Wiesel is the saint of that. And I keep trying to point this out in different ways because I'm totally convinced about it. And I could write an article that gives all the reasons why this is so, like this movie they've made, In the Footsteps of Elie Wiesel. You know, there's a movie that's been made. Doesn't that sound like Jesus Christ? They've got 12 high school students who were able to travel in the footsteps of Elie Wiesel, and they paid for them to go first to his hometown in Sighet in Romania. And, you know, like he's a great saint, and they looked there, and then they went to Auschwitz, and then they went probably to Buchenwald, and then they went to Paris, and you know they're following his life because he's this superhuman person now, and so they are they have to get this fixed up, and so that's part of what this work is of in Marion Wiesel's new 2006 translation. And I also say that eventually the old one, the original one, will just be discontinued, will go by the wayside, will be forgotten. But fortunately, they were not able to do that immediately, or they didn't think they were. They couldn't just trash all those original books that were out there. and just trash everything that's been written about his book, Night, that it was, you know, in saying that it's a novel and, you know, and how it's not exactly like Elie Wiesel and so on. So they're doing it in kind of a slow fashion, little by little, but I'm quite sure that the plan is that they get this new translation established, and pretty soon the old one won't be available at all. It won't be published, and eventually it will just go down the memory hole that there never was one. And a lot of things will go down the memory hole. This is how falsification of history takes place. So, you know, this is not something to be taken lightly. And a lot of people, people who consider themselves revisionists are not interested in finding out that Elie Wiesel wasn't at Auschwitz and he wasn't at Buchenwald, because they're quite happy with the fact that he wrote about it in ways that are unreal and don't fit the way the camp was. And for some reason, they think that is more helpful to the revisionist cause than what I'm doing, or then to find out that he wasn't there at all. If he wasn't there at all, then they can't use all those stories that he wrote about as showing that, well, the favorite one is that he was put in a hospital for his foot. And so they like to say, well, see, he was put in a hospital. I understand that, but it's short-sighted, because we have to get to the real truth. And the real truth about what Elie Wiesel is up to and the people who support him are up to is much worse than just having him as an example of someone who was put in the hospital at Auschwitz, at Monowitz, so it couldn't have been such a bad place. It wasn't an extermination camp if people were put in a hospital. Well, okay, I understand that, but this is a short-sighted view, and yet I run into it quite a bit, which is why I'm mentioning it here. I'm not trying to, I'm trying to get people to consider, in this program about why real history is important. You know, David Irving always talked about real history, and he did fantastic work. I have my problems with David Irving as far as the Holocaust goes, but he did fantastic work to bring out facts of history that were being suppressed and were not going to come out. And he talked about being an exponent of real history. Well, this is what I'm talking about here, real history too. Let's not be satisfied with certain beliefs that we currently have because we think they're effective or we can use them effectively if they're not the true history. That's just as bad as what they're doing. So we need real history. We need to fight against this falsification because it is Orwellian. And as I said at the beginning of my announcement for this program, and I want to repeat this, I think it's so good, I'm glad I came upon it. There is only one sin committed against mankind and its generation, and that is the falsification of history. And this was written by Friedrich Hebbels, who was a poet and dramatist back before Adolf Hitler was, he died before Adolf Hitler was even born. But notice that he says, he's not saying there's only one sin committed, you know, and that's the falsification of history. He's saying that this is this one sin committed against mankind and its generation, its offspring, its continued generations of mankind, that when we falsify history, the future generations don't have the right picture. They've got a false picture. And there comes a point when there is nobody who can correct that, and nothing can be done about it. Although there is still amazing ability of scholars to go into what is there, you know, books, historical accounts and so on, and reconstruct true history. And it's being done, but we have this huge, campaign, this huge amount of, powerful, this power group that is truly intent on falsifying our history. And that little business about Dresden and what they want to say about that, that's an example. This business about creepy, you know, goofy Elie Wiesel and his book Night. It might seem unimportant, but it's not. It's an example of that. And all of this takes us into a future that is entirely constructed of lies. So that's why I did this program tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. And next week, ladies and gentlemen, I'll have Rodney Martin here. This is Carolyn Yeager for Heretics. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.